There's also I think it's going to be this Tuesday, February 23rd, there's going to be a lecture by Ginny Klugman. It's called the Party Distinguished Lecture, and she's going to be giving a lecture on the Human Development Reports. She was the director and lead author of the UNDP Human Development Reports, and so that should be really interesting. It's going to be, it's going to be at 595 Commonwealth Avenue at the fourth floor conference area of the Rafiq Hariri School of Management Building. That's at BU at Boston University, and it starts at 11:45 a.m. So if you want to go hear about an interesting person who works for the UN, that would be a cool opportunity. Another annuncio for you is going to be the Ideas Competition Spring Generator Dinner, and it's going to be this Wednesday, February 24th. And if you didn't know, the Ideas Competition is a competition at MIT where you can come up with cool ideas that benefit people in underserved communities. And you don't have to be an MIT student to join. You just have to have MIT students on your team. So, and I know some really cool people who just randomly like stopped by a generator ideas competition one day, and they got involved in all these really cool projects. So if you ever were interested in engineering or even like a socials type of project and you want to check it out, it's on this coming Wednesday, February 24th at 6 p.m., and it's in Walker Memorial. So
that would be right here.
Yeah, at MIT.
Lo vamos a poner en español. ¿Sí?
Sí, el miércoles 24 de febrero tendremos aquí en MIT el concurso de ideas de primavera. Una cena para aquellos que están que tengan idea todo miembro de la comunidad que tenga alguna idea, que esté generando una idea, no necesariamente ser estudiante de MIT, pero estar parte del proyecto, que tenga estudiantes de MIT, lo que te ayuda, es lo que necesitas para hacer para que puedas calificar a este programa.
Y básicamente eso es una competencia, ¿no? La idea de organizar algo y luego en esta cena, entonces se pueden conversar acerca de la posibilidad.
Another event that's coming up is there's going to be a lecture on the origins of crimes against humanity, the Russian Empire International Law and the 1915 note on the Armenian genocide. And it's going to be at 4 p.m. on next Wednesday, February 24th. Hope you enjoyed Sverio today, and have a wonderful week.
Stay happy, everyone.
From Rasputina, and you're listening to WMBR Cambridge and Ghost Rider of Sleepy Holler.
Africa Kabisa, Boston's African music radio show for the genuine ambiance of Africa and beyond. Nowhere else on the dial can you find this mix of African and Afro-Caribbean rhythms plus interviews and everything you want to know about African events happening in the area. I'm your host, Julia, inviting you to join me every Sunday for Africa Kabisa. That's Africa Absolutely, right here on WMBR Cambridge 88.1 FM and streaming live at WMBR.org.
I believe I said marhaban. Marhaban to you. I am Dr. Jalis Sakran, and I welcome you to Music for Human. Music for Human is New Age talk radio with an emphasis on you. And it is a very glorious, glorious evening. I am joined this evening by Professor Levine. Professor, welcome.
Hello, and I can just say that it's my most deep and deepest pleasure to be with you again.
The pleasure is deeper and deeper.
I feel that every week that I'm on here on this show, speaking to you, speaking to all the listeners, the pleasure penetrates to ever deeper layers.
Sort of drilling in deeper.
Deeper.
And do you feel changed by the experience?
Oh, yes. In fact, I'd say over the past year of my life in general, I felt a great change. I felt myself converging into a sort of life philosophy, along with you, Dr. Jalas, and along with all our listeners, and I think we've had this really wonderful journey together, and I'm really just so pleased to be able to share it. Although the other night I did have a somewhat disturbing dream. I dreamt that I was sharing a dorm room, sort of a regression back to childhood. And there was some sort of pressure differential in this room, so that both sides of the room needed to be pressurized appropriately, so the pressure would be even across the room for the appropriate airflow. It was very strange.
It is unusual. I think this is symbolic. It's like, you know, at the beginning of the journey, I had this image in mind that I would someday become a perfect being. Gradually, the changes would make me a being that no longer required change. But of course, I realized that a perfect being would not need change, that it would not require change. And yet my only hope for perfection was in my ability to change.
Well, one of the other paradoxes of that idea of perfection is that a truly perfect being would have no need to exist. And so if one were to achieve perfection, one would cease to exist in all planes of existence as a separate entity. So I think one of the fears of humanity is this dissolution of the self into the universe. And that's part of our fear of death. And sort of continuing in this bizarre dream, one of the other elements of this dream was that somehow I had truly been complicit in some sort of murder, a bombing. And I didn't remember why I had done it, but I knew that I had been convicted. And apparently the result was that I was going to spend 5 years in jail. But this jail was not like an ordinary jail where you live in a cell, but it was one where you can't move at all. You're fully constricted. Your body is totally immobilized. This sort of deep, dark jail of the body. And I was pondering the fact that I was going to spend 5 years in this sort of suspended bodily state. And I was thinking I might get very bored. And I thought the boredom might be a problem. It'd be hard to read books. It'd be hard to do very much at all if one can't move one's body.
And so that you would gradually deteriorate.
Yes, this was my fear. It wasn't quite a nightmare. My family was there, and they seemed to think it wasn't such a bad idea that maybe somehow going into this sort of suspended animation would be a net positive in my life. But I was a bit anxious about it.
Let's for a moment suspend our thoughts of philanthropy and imagine what we would do to have a most perfect prison, because to me, a prison where if I really was intending to torture someone, I could not do this by imprisoning them so completely. It would be necessary to leave the imprisoned person a long life, a long and miserable life, so they would have to remain in health, you know, perpetually.
Hmm.
It would be one of the requirements of a perfect prison.
Well, of course, some ancient religious thinkers believed that this world, this life itself, is a sort of prison, and that somehow part of the deep yearning of man and woman and child and animal is to escape the bonds of this worldly prison and to be able to ascend to a sort of deeper plane and a deeper level of existence. And that's something I think we try to do on this show. We try to bring our listeners to a higher plane.
That raising is so, is such a goal.
Right. But, and I mean, especially for people who are born somewhat shorter than average, who are naturally somewhat lower to the ground.
Lower stature.
That spiritual elevation can be used to compensate for the shortness of height.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen many men who are short of stature, like Roman Polanski, but have yet been able to attract very lovely, taller women mm-hmm. because of their spiritual ascendancy.
And so somehow the it may be seen that a greater height would make it more difficult to reach greater spiritual elevations, because you are, it's so easy to become consumed by one's perfection in some other dimension.
Yes, I think in general this is a problem for extremely beautiful people, and I did have this problem in my youth before the various, you know, skin corrosion set in, scarring my face. This beauty was a real impediment to my spiritual growth, because I felt constant adulation from everyone, and this constant desire that I felt everyone wanted to either be me or be with me.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I never thought about anything deeper. I just basked. And too much basking can make you a basket case.
It's true. The words, there is a relation there.
Yeah, bask. Basket. Baskin Robbins.
Over basking.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this idea of change is such a critical thing. It strikes me that perhaps what permits us to live outside of prison, outside of a spiritual prison, is the ability to change and to respond and to grow. And that a true prison would be one that denied a person of spiritual growth, so that one would simply fester as a mundane being. So if I wish to really imprison someone, the prison would be a prison where they are lauded by all around them falsely, that they have people surrounding them that are praising them without reason, and I would permit them freedom of movement, and I would permit them certain earthly pleasures that would prevent them from being forced to look inward and to grow.
Saffron. Well, I often, when I am walking down the street in, you know, Central Square, other places such as Central Square, and a destitute man says, "Can you spare any change, sir?" I say, "Yes, I have change, and I will spare it, and I will give you my change." And I take him by the hand, and I walk with him to my place of meditation, and I sit down with him, and I meditate with him. And then we meditate, and afterwards he says, "But do you have any change?" And I said, "No, sorry, I only have bills." And I send him on his way.
And you have left him with one type of change.
But not the other.
But not the other.
You know, one of the other things I was thinking about recently was that I have this strong belief that humor and laughter is the basis of humanity. And I don't know if you'll agree with this, but this thought came to me that somehow humor is this sort of essential element which makes us human. And that in that way, comedians are in fact in some way paragons of spirituality by definition.
Because they really embrace this aspect.
They release the laughter from us all.
Well, if you would like to join us in the human release. The number is 617-253-8810, and we would love to be released. Caller, marhaban.
It's very nice to hear you basking again. I heard of a very nice meditation called the smile meditation. And I thought that was really great.
Well, so caller, what does the smile meditation entail?
You just sit and smile.
I think this is based on this concept called proprioception.
Proprioception.
Proprioception, which is this idea that bodily symbols, which are usually the output of an emotion, can also lead to the emotion. So that if one, let's say one needs to fire an employee, but one is not angry, one can frown and scowl and work oneself into a lather.
So that one can approach a state which would have produced the
desired
physical manifestations.
Yeah, of course, you know, in the New Age thought movement, we really believe in positive emotions mostly. So the smile meditation is really, can be very powerful. And I find also that beyond just smiling, the manner of one's walk, one's gait, can have a strong effect on one's mood. And I really believe this, and I really sincerely...
Skipping would be nice.
Skipping would be nice. Skipping is great. If one wants to do it in a more subtle way, one can walk with a sort of jauntiness. And
a bounce
is usually a symbol of happiness, along with long and large arm movements. Happy people tend to move their arms very nicely.
Swinging your arms
a little bit. A swing and a jaunt with your walk, a little bounce in your step, a smile on your face, and your chin lifted high.
Sounds much better than frowning.
I notice you're talking a lot about reincarnation lately and changing yourself. The last time I listened, it was about that too. And I wonder if you'd like to hear the story of Ivan Asokin. It's very short.
Please share.
Well, Ivan Asokin is a story written by P.D. Ouspensky, and it's about a guy who gets to be about 35 or so, and then he realizes that everything has been a shortcut and an easy answer, and now he wants to be mature, and he's decided that he always takes the easy way out, so he's decided to change. So he goes to a wizard, and he asks the wizard if he could live his life over again. So the wizard says, yeah, but as long as you don't remember it, you don't remember that this is a new life. So he's born again, and he lives his life till he's 35, and he thinks, I've done everything the easy way. If only I could go find a wizard and live my life over again.
So that the trade-off left him in a cycle.
Didn't work.
Is that the snake eating its own tail, perhaps?
The Ouroboros? Well, I'm not sure. It's a legend often that one is given the opportunity to make a trade, and sometimes the sacrifice one is asked to make is too great.
Do you think you would change anything if you had your life over again?
If I could... I think that I could not have reached the place that I am at any other way but by living the life that I have lived. And I sometimes regret that I was, you know, I had not been able to... I was not as mature as I am now when I was younger, but this is how I was created.
Well, you're hardly ever mature when you're younger.
I think we aren't. So I think that it's perhaps not wise to regret.
Well, I think I do. I wouldn't call it a regret, but I think I've reached a certain stage in my life where if I had to cycle back and start again, I would take one idea with me, and that would be the idea of putting oneself in uncomfortable situations, being willing to put yourself out there, outside of your comfort zone, taking risks, and just exploring a lot.
I like that.
I like that too.
I think that it's an important thing in education that a person, the young student, becomes acquainted early with dealing with hard things and, you know, working hard on their own brain, on things that, the ideas that they find difficult to grasp. And I feel like a similar lesson should be learned in life in general. The student of language, I think, often learns this, especially, that they must be willing to make mistakes and to make a fool of themselves if they wish to learn.
Yes, I can give one example. I am a bit of a fan of dancing to the funk and soul and blues genre. And I decided to expand my horizons and to try this form of dance known as the Lindy Hop, which is a form of swing dancing. And so I went to this recreational Lindy Hop dance, and I had never done it before. And I sort of flailed around at first. And then a series of very kind women took pity on me. They saw my flailing and my incompetence and my stepping on my own toes. And the series of four or five women came to dance with me and offered their assistance and really encouraged me. And I thought it was a very amazing and affirming experience. I felt so uncomfortable that I sort of reveled in the uncomfortableness because I knew that I was learning something new and it would be something that I could keep with me and really nurture in the future.
Because the discomfort is temporary, it's transient.
Exactly, it's the beginning. All we say in the Talmud that all beginnings are difficult. And they're painful sometimes, but sometimes they're really necessary. And I think this relates to this issue of change and reincarnation. And on the same topic, I did see, I think I've mentioned before on the show, I've seen Planet Earth, this amazing BBC-produced nature documentary about the planet.
Yes, I remember that.
Well, this one scene is of the cicadas. And the cicadas are these amazing creatures, these insects, that have a multi-year life cycle. I think it's, is it 8 years or so?
I thought it was 17.
17 years, perhaps, yeah. Every 17 years, they emerge from the ground in mass swarms. And they're these winged, these little winged creatures. And they swarm into the trees, and they climb up the trees, and they climb and climb and climb as high as they can get. And then their skin gets a little brittle, gets a little hard, and they start to shake it off a little bit, right? I'm sorry, they're not winged initially. At this point, they're not winged. They're just crawling up the tree. And they shake away their scaly old skin, and they split it open, and they break out. And there emerges a new type of creature. A metamorphosis has occurred, and there's this winged insect now, which can fly. And it's really this incredible transformation. They're a new type of creature. They're very weak at first. They start flying, and they can't really fly very well because those flying muscles haven't really developed much.
Do you think they feel brave, or do you think it's just instinct and they just do that because it's programmed?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if there are any instances of a cicada that was afraid to come out of its shell. But, of course, as human beings, we're not programmed, and so we have to be brave when we want to escape those shells and metamorphosize ourselves. But I think we do have the opportunity to really change at any point in our lives.
I heard of a woman who was going blind, and she wanted to jump out of an airplane and float down on a parachute, and her children were very mad and didn't want her to do it, so she said, well, I'm going to anyway. And she jumped out, and on her way down, the pressure relieved the problem with her eyes, and when she landed, she could see.
And she went on to become a famous skier, I believe.
No, but she could see, which is pretty good.
I mean, did she not just win a gold medal in the Winter Olympics?
No, it's not that good.
Well, I think the implication there is that her instinct was perfect. It directed her precisely as the stone directs itself to the bottom of the pond.
It, oh, I like that.
It's simply...
Is that a Zen idea? Stone dropping to the bottom of the pond.
I'm not sure, but I often think of this image when I find that I'm faced with a difficult situation that I resist, and I make waves, and I agitate myself, I agitate the people around me, and I remember the stone who drops in the quickest way to the bottom of the pond with the least effort. Simply by not resisting, by letting it happen.
Now, what is Zen exactly? As I'm a student of Jewish mysticism and some other forms, but I never studied Zen. My understanding was that it was some sort of motorcycle maintenance technique.
there's a book called that. I think it's not a religion. It's a way of living and. A simple way of living. I've been reading about it. It's interesting. I think I should probably let someone else call now and say good night.
Well, thank you so much again for joining us, caller.
Okay, good night.
Good night. And I guess we can throw out that number again. Of course, we'd love to hear from any and all of you simultaneously, perhaps. Other phone lines might burst.
Yeah, it's never happened.
The bursting of the phone lines.
But all things are possible.
I wonder if the phone lines bursted, whether somehow... Oh, I think we do have a caller, but let me throw out the number. 617-253-8810.
Marhaban, caller.
Hello.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hello, sir.
Welcome to the air.
How are you doing?
Good, we're well. How are you?
I'm lost and found.
You are lost and found?
Yeah.
Well, who lost you and who found you?
I guess maybe... I'm kind of lost and found myself.
You lost yourself and then you found yourself.
Yeah.
I think that's all of us there. I'm not sure if we start out found or lost, but I think that maybe at some point in our lives we discover that we are lost. And some of us are fortunate enough to realize it and others simply remain lost. And out of those that realize it, some of them can rescue themselves, and some of them, I think, never do.
Well, I do believe that finding a lost item can be one of those deep and amazingly simple pleasures in life. So I know I often tend to lose my hat, and I lost my hat recently, and it was a nice hat that I bought at this clothing store called... something was called Gap, the Gap, or a Gap. And I had worn it for over a decade or so, and I was sort of upset. And then I drove to buy a new one, and the Gap was gone. And
there was a space where the Gap had been.
Yes, and instead I went to this store called Jack's Liquidation Outlet. And I bought a hat for 99 cents, and that was better than the Gap hat.
And newer.
Newer, and then I found the Gap hat.
All things come. Well, let's bring a second caller to join with us. Caller 2, marhaban.
Hey. Well, I get nervous in social situations. What should I do?
In general?
Yeah.
Well, I think that the first thing might be to consider whether or not it is a problem. I mean, all of us, I think, get somewhat nervous. Is caller one still there? Caller one?
Well, one life choice that can be made is to become what's known as a shut-in. And I think this is
that's
not...
that's what I'm doing.
It's not for everyone, but some people might actually live a very fulfilling life shut in.
Well, caller two,
and what, my pooped pan is starting to smell.
What exactly happens to you in social situations?
Usually I freeze up. I don't know what to say next. And I pee a little.
So it's really an obstacle in your life?
No, I mean...
So it hasn't right. been a problem?
It's all right.
Well, I think it's fine then, caller. I wouldn't worry.
I mean, everyone has their own idiosyncrasies, and I think if we get too hung up about them, whether it's public urination or walking in a funny way, then we get sort of bogged down by the perceptions that others have of us instead of just being ourselves.
Are you trying to say walk funny?
Well, I find that often public urinators tend to walk funny too. They tend to... Two traits tend to go hand in hand, or as we might say, leg.
And leg, leg and leg and leg.
Leg and leg, yeah.
Point taken. Well, thank you.
Well, it's our pleasure to help, caller. Yeah, and I'm sorry that we lost our first caller. So, our listeners should know that we have two lines. So, you know.
Which I think symbolizes the ultimate duality of existence.
Yeah, I think it symbolizes that.
Or perhaps just the fact that two lines are cost-effective and three are somewhat expensive. And being mostly non-profit-focused people...
Completely listener-funded.
Listener-funded and spiritually funded, I would say also.
Precisely. But I mean, where would we be without spirit?
Non-monetarily funded for the most part.
But back to this issue of change. Because I was thinking a great deal about how things are changed. And it seems to me, let me propose the following theory. I think that in large part, changes are subtractive things. So let me elaborate that in the formation of something, we begin by assembling some number or some quantity of some material, and then to actually produce the shape or behavior or mechanism that we like, we remove those things which are excess. And this process is made simpler by reducing the amount of material that we begin with, because this reduces the number of possibilities for the final shape. So the ideal formation has nothing is needed, no removal is needed, but this is the least flexible.
Right, and I think the more material you have, the more future directions stay.
The more opportunities you have, the more difficult it is to find your way.
And I know that psychologically speaking, some human beings, like our listeners, may find the excitement of the possible more powerful than the excitement of the here and now. And I think you have to achieve a sort of balance. I mean, you can't live your life in some future dream world, but you also need to keep in mind the possibility of changing and of bringing about goals and wishes.
And not only the possibility, but also the inevitability that time will, you know, I'm thinking a great deal about mechanical or machining analogy, that I have a quantity of some metal, perhaps, so an aluminum or... a brass or something, and I would like to form a clock or a gear. And so I begin by making a mold and pouring the metal, but there is too much, and so I take it and with a knife I gradually remove, or with sand or some other abrasive, I remove the pieces, the excess pieces of material until I have the shape that I like. And I think that we undergo a similar thing. Now, even though I would like the piece once formed to never change, time wears it down. It's inevitable that it will gradually deteriorate. And likewise, it is not a matter of trying to prevent change, but really a matter of accepting and selecting the change that we would like. And sometimes we are not given many options. Marhaban, caller. Caller?
Ah?
Yes, welcome, caller.
Calling Dr. Reaver.
Caller, are you with us? Well, it is always, you know, you see how I mentioned that sometimes we have very few choices and we cannot select the change that we would like.
It is always an adventure, I think, when we just we see some light flashing and that says there's a voice out there in the ether, in the universe, that wants to commune with you.
Precisely.
And you have no information about this voice. You just see a flashing light and you say, I will press the button and I will commune with this voice, knowing nothing about it.
And when the visitor knocks the door of your cave, do you open the door? There is no peephole. There is no portal. You simply open the door.
And you jump.
Or you leave it closed.
Or you jump.
And often jumping is not even an option. Sometimes I jump and everything is the same except all the pots have fallen off the wall.
Yes, that does remind me of the Buddhist metaphor of the stapler, which I actually forget right now, but there is some very powerful metaphor about a stapler with stuck staples. And I was thinking about that a bit today because I was stapling some sheafs of paper with meditation mantras.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me that it's amazing that this stapler, which is an old technology, has seemingly not progressed at all in the past century or so. It's stuck and stuck and stuck. And I wonder if anyone could solve the problem of the stapler, I would willingly give my life savings, both spiritual and monetary, to this person.
Well, let's bring in a voice that perhaps can help with that. Caller, marhaban. Caller?
This is the grammar doctor calling to remind you that the plural of sheaf is sheaves. Thank you very much.
Once again, you know,
it's just a voice, and I love corrections. I mean, I myself believe that grammar is the fluid mechanism of communication.
Yeah, very flexible.
I believe in flexibility of grammar, and I believe that part of human creativity is making grammatical errors, at least what one caller views as an error, another caller might view as some sort of beautiful message.
Or an exploration with a purpose of a particular emphasis. You know, language can shock you. And like the water, we do not begin to ripple until the stone has actually struck the surface.
Right, and I'm reminded of the poet E.E. Cummings, who famously failed to capitalize his sentences, and I've often pondered what was the message? What was the message of not using capitalization? Was it merely some sort of aesthetic sensibility that liked this sort of evenness, no beginning, no symbolization of a beginning?
Mm-hmm.
Just start right in the middle?
Yeah.
Is that the idea?
Many languages simply don't have capitals at all.
Some sentences don't have beginnings, and some sentences don't have endings.
That's another thing. I found that when I was in grammar school, our teacher instructed us that a story, one of the requirements of a story was change, that someone or something in the story had to change. But later I began exploring the possibility that nothing would change, that we would simply bask in a moment and accept that change would not happen, or if it did happen, that it would happen after the writing or before, that it was not, the writing was the moment.
Well, when I myself was in grammar school, when our teacher was actually a former but reformed Nazi, the grammar teacher, and so we used to jokingly refer to him as the grammar Nazi. It was sort of a pun.
It was ironic.
Yeah.
Let's bring a caller on. Caller, marhaban.
Hello?
Yes, welcome, caller.
Hello, yes. I just wanted to say that I heard the grammar police guy come on, and if ever there was a need to heed the lesson of the stone in the pond falling to the bottom, I think there would be that.
You would like to tie that collar to a stone and throw them to the bottom of the pond?
I think that they need to let themselves go a little bit in the sphere of grammar. And I wanted to tie the collar to the stone, and I also wanted to tie that thought to something that was stated earlier, that sort of I wanted to see what you thought of this. If sort of a state of nothingness or a reduction of to non-existence is considered perfect, would then the perfect sentence be one that has no words?
I really like that that extension. I like that. I think that is the logical conclusion, and it seems that well, there is a saying, right, that silence is golden. And among us, among the Arab, there is a great deal of respect for a person who can communicate with the fewest words. Because somehow there is imperfection in each word and in each production.
Sure. And the more words you use, the more grammar you need, and on the other more perfect end of the scale, you'd have no words and no need for grammar, and you just sort of let yourself go like the stone.
Precisely, the movement of the stone also is not it's not in a straight line, and you know, as much as we would like to approximate it, it is only that curve.
I think this ideal of silence was probably epitomized by the great philosopher Harpo Marx, who, besides being a great philosopher, was also an entertainer and a comic, of course, in these famous series of the Marx Brothers movies throughout the 20th century. And I have a little collection of Harpo Marx movies, and I watch him with care, and I try sometimes to imitate his lack of speaking and his little honky horn.
He insists on silence, and the silence is somehow a thwarting of our attempt to hear him.
But yet he communicates perfectly. He has a little horn with a little rubber ball, and somehow that horn is enough to always get his point across. And I wonder what it would be like to maybe vow to take a week and during that week to only communicate with a little horn with a rubber ball.
But what about Groucho?
Well, Groucho, of course, is the antithesis of Harpo in that way, right? Groucho is quite verbal.
And hence the embodiment of imperfection?
You know what? I think Harpo is happier than Groucho is.
Harpo is a more centered being. Groucho has multiple layers. His id is quite submerged. His superego is thin. And he's a multi-layered creature. He's complicated. Whereas Harpo has sort of found that transcendent spiritual silence, that center.
So perhaps either Harpo was formed with less material and hence could be a simpler being, or had found a way to remove that which complicated his life.
That sounds more like Zeppo to me. But he wasn't in all the movies.
Well, I thought about this multiple times, that I've known people in my life, I've come across them, who seemed by nature somewhat angelic. They seemed like selfless people who didn't really have this any spark of dishonesty or deception to them. They just seemed like a simple, single-layered being. And it's always a pleasure to meet such people. I myself am quite the exact opposite. Sort of, you get, with complexity, you get sneakiness, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, it occurred to me earlier that one of my relatives told me when I was young that a true friend to me would be, and that I should keep close to me those who, not those who made me laugh, but those who made me cry, those who made me, who forced me to examine my life, but in a positive way, you know.
See, I would keep those close to you who can make you laugh and cry at the same time. Because with the crying must come laughter, must come the possibility of change and redemption.
But the logical extension to me was a realization that I had only recently, which was that similar to this issue of the prison, is that if one wished to really be an enemy of someone else, that they would be there and tell them not to change. Tell them that they should embrace their faults. And it seemed like an incredibly insidious way to live. But,
politeness as a sort of form of evil.
Yeah, but beyond politeness, enabling.
I mean, I believe politeness has its place.
But not as an enabler of stasis.
Precisely. I mean, I think politeness is a necessary thing, but it is really only a layer.
Well, I think it's overused in the Midwest, for example. So I actually avoid traveling throughout that part of the country because I find
you
the politeness...
people to be more direct.
I like the directness. I like the simplicity of directness. And so I tend to avoid any area west of Ohio and east of Nevada. So I find that area is especially overly polite, and I find it somewhat offensive.
It's somehow true also that the people that you can be impolite with are those that you are closest to, so that when you are being impolite, it is not always a sign of, you know, a need to generate distance, but it may also be
familiarity.
Precisely, we are close enough that I can be impolite with you.
And I think we're all human beings, we're all really familiar with each other in a certain way, and we should be able to be familiar. We should be able to talk to strangers and to maybe
challenge them
to a fight or slap them if need be.
Is this like the propriocentrism by proxy, where you could behave in a very aggressive and impolitic manner and then sort of invoke that behavior in a stranger opposite you?
Force them to smile in some way, or inject the bounce into their walk by actually bouncing on their shoulders, perhaps.
It's interesting. I think that actually a more successful venture might be to offer passers-by perhaps a very small amount of money to smile. And then I think that if you simply request in Boston someone that you meet, you tell them, please smile, it is unlikely.
They'll probably spit on your face.
It's possible. But if you offer them even so little as a dollar, then I think it's much more likely that they will smile.
And a little beer usually helps, a little thimbleful. So I tend to carry on this little case full of thimbles, full of frothy beer.
But don't you find that...
You wouldn't eat it in Ohio. Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's fine. But I mean that there is so much mistrust that they may not... I mean, especially that myself, I would walk around and say, I'm an Arab here, have some of my my drink and enjoy, that it's unlikely that they would take it. But if I offer them a bill, a small money, and I say, smile. Here is this money. Please smile. That it would be enough to actually make them smile, but that the individual themselves would never be able to tell themselves, I smiled for a dollar, because it's not enough.
Well, instead of maybe taking this direct approach and demanding a smile, one can just induce it through one's behavior. And so this sort of idea of being a performer throughout one's life and entertaining, I think, is a very powerful idea.
So that you can encourage the smile.
Yeah.
Let's bring a fourth voice briefly on the air with us. Caller 2, marhaban.
Hi, what do you think about the Viva Palestina convoys of relief that have been going to Gaza and the way that Egypt has told them they can't go through anymore?
First of all, is caller 1 still with us? I think we may have lost him. Caller 1? And caller 2? Wow, we lost both of our callers. Well, I confess that I'm not really up to date on what is going on in Gaza, but I'm not sure if this is really the appropriate forum.
Yeah, I mean, myself, I've sort of instituted a news blackout for my own sanity about 25 years ago, and I haven't really consumed any piece of media since then. I sort of live in my own 4 cubits. And personally, I have no opinion on the subject, and I tend to just focus on spiritual matters. And going back to our previous conversation about, you know, making strangers smile, I did have this one idea, and I haven't quite implemented it yet, but I'm thinking about it, where one can somehow approach a stranger and ask them a very serious question about life, about their life philosophy, and try to actually get a real answer. And I think this might be possible in certain situations, to actually start conversations with strangers, perhaps in a bar or a salon or a coffee shop. And it's strange and it can be awkward, but this is part of putting yourself outside your comfort zone and really just bonding with humanity. And I think it's an interesting idea.
To simply open the forum immediately with the possibility of discussing important things.
Yes.
And I think it is simple. Well, let's briefly take a final call. Marhaban, caller.
Hello?
Yes, welcome, caller.
Hi. I'm not sure if this is the best time. I figured I'd maybe try to call at the end of the show. I just had a question about the music for the program. I'm a musician myself, and I was just wondering if it was done live or if it's pre-recorded, if there was any way to compose maybe a piece for the program or how that worked.
Well, caller, why don't I put you on hold and then maybe we can speak off the air?
Okay, sure.
I think that is a great question, and we do a mix of live and pre-recorded stuff. This happens to be live right now, and I don't even know the name of these instruments. We have a little room in the back where we have this about being played by about 20 people, including several Indonesians.
But caller, thank you. Let me put you on hold, and we'll have someone speak with you shortly.
Okay.
Well, but I think it would be great to have our listeners creatively contribute to the show.
Precisely, as well.
Anyway, and I really would encourage that.
And yeah, musically as well as verbally.
As mentally and spiritually and even monetarily, if they would wish to do so.
Well, the fundraising is in November. But Professor Levine, of course, it has been wonderful again to be here and to commune with you and to change with you.
Oh, my pleasure bore even deeper. This time.
It really is driving in.
It bored.
Tremendous. I am Dr. Jalis Sakran here on Music for Humans, which is New Age talk radio with an emphasis on you, every Friday at 7 p.m. here on WMBR Cambridge. Ma'a salama.
points for safety.
Number one.
Cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two.
Look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three.
Cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four.
Cars and bikes.